I have no idea what it is or how it got there, and this is the first time I've seen it in my life. If you say it's a piece of evidence, then someone planted it. But that isn't what he said. So either he wrote it there, or had strong reason to believe that he did, and didn't want to get caught up in any more lies. The Majestic Alibi. One of the more controversial aspects of the Hauptmann defense was when he actually started work at the Majestic Apartments. He claimed that on March 1, 1932, the day of the kidnapping, he was working there until 5 p.m., which would have made it difficult for him to have been at the Hopewell House at the right time. The prosecution claimed that time and pay records indicated Hauptmann had not started working at the Majestic until March 16th. Ludovic Kennedy puts forth evidence that worksheets showing Hauptmann was on the job as a carpenter in Manhattan on March 1st were tampered with to make it look as if he had not started until after March 15th, the next pay period. Prosecutor David Willens and the Bronx District Attorney had seen these records and had them handed over to NYPD for safekeeping. The payroll records were never seen again. The sheets showing that Hauptmann quit on April 2nd appear to have been tampered with. The defense subpoenaed the Majestic timekeeper, Edward Morton, to bring his timesheets to an extradition hearing, but Morton failed to show up. Enough muddiness exists on this issue to throw serious doubt on the prosecution's contention about where Hauptmann was or wasn't on March 1st. Rail 16. This is the single most important piece of evidence upon which the case against Bruno Richard Hauptmann hinges. It remains one of the most famous pieces of evidence in the history of modern criminology, right up there with the JFK magic bullet and the Simpson case glove. First, let us consider the latter itself. It has often been described as crude and homemade. But when you actually look at it closely, it is pretty ingenious. It seems crude because it is so light, and the rungs are so much farther apart than on a normal ladder. Well, it had to be light to carry easily, and when Mark Olshaker and I examined it, we thought that whoever built it knew exactly how far apart the rungs could be spaced and still allow climbing. In other words, no more than absolutely necessary. The sectional structure is equally ingenious. The first two sections fold together on hinges, and the third section fits onto the second section if it is needed. This ladder had been thought through and designed by someone who could visualize the finished product. Someone like a carpenter. And don't forget the ladder sketches found in Hauptmann's notebook. Then we get to the two prongs of Arthur Kaler's research. The first used wood samples and cutting blade patterns to pinpoint the most likely location where the lumber was prepared, shipped, and sold. Can it be just an amazing coincidence that the place he came up with was right there in the Bronx? Even more amazing, Hauptmann once worked for National Lumber in Millwork. Of course, like everything else about this case, some have questioned Kaler's research methods, techniques, and assumptions. But I have seen no compelling argument that his analysis was incorrect. And now we come to the heart of the latter case. On Wednesday, September 26, 1934, 2 days after Henry Bruckman had found the phone number and address on the molding inside Manfred's closet, police were once again looking around Hauptmann's attic for clues. According to the official account, they noticed a gap in the floor. One floorboard about 8 feet long in the southwest corner had been removed. Where the board was missing, there were empty nail holes in 4 successive joists where it would have been hammered down. Kaler determined by matching grain patterns and nail holes that rail 16 of the kidnap ladder had been the board removed from the attic. It could have been, based on the prosecution's theory, that Hauptmann ran out of lumber at the last minute and so had to use what was on hand. But like everything else, this theory has also been disputed. Hauptmann's defenders point out that the police had been poking around the attic several times before they noticed the gap. Is this the kind of thing you miss? Then they also point out that the police had exclusive access to the apartment for several days after the arrest. They wouldn't even let in the FBI. The matter was cleared up as a misunderstanding about jurisdiction, according to a memorandum of September 28, 1934, from J. Edgar Hoover, who, though annoyed, seemed to accept the police explanation. But technically speaking, if you're going to plant evidence, this would be the time. The opportunity was there, and so was the motivation. But let's look at the big picture. We've examined the ladder and Arthur Kaler's analysis of the matching grain patterns and find it compelling, despite a several-inch gap between the end of rail 16 and the rest of the board still in place in the attic. What this means is that if police did plant evidence, they would have had to remove the actual rail 16 from the ladder and replace it with a substitute cut from a certain piece of board. They would then have had to remove a board from Hauptmann's attic floor and replace it with the remainder of the board from which the substitute rail 16 had been fashioned, being careful to create new nail holes that lined up with the existing nail holes in the four joists underneath. They would have had to destroy the original rail 16, but make sure that the substitute looked enough like it in terms of grain, coloration, contour, and distress marks, so that if anyone happened to compare it with one of the original photographs taken just after the crime, they couldn't tell the difference. And then, on top of all that, the men who pulled off this switcheroo would have had to be awfully damn sure that anyone and everyone involved in the conspiracy was completely reliable and that no one would spill. Because if even one person did, not only would the case against Hauptmann be in terrible jeopardy, but each of them would be out of a job and facing serious penitentiary time for tampering with evidence. It's one thing to try to influence witnesses to be a little more authoritative in their identifications. It's quite another to out-and-out falsify evidence, especially when the FBI already has its nose out of joint and would like nothing better than to slam the police. Making a payroll book that almost no one's seen before disappear is one thing if you want to tamper with evidence. Making a piece of the ladder disappear is quite another. Though I do wonder why a carpenter who had access to plenty of lumber would have to cannibalize his own attic for a piece of wood. For these reasons, I find it extremely difficult to believe that Rail 16 did not actually come from the spot the police and prosecution said it did. Putting together the pieces. I think there has to be serious question as to whether Bruno Richard Hauptmann got a fair trial. Forgetting even the circus atmosphere and the nation's call for blood, particularly against a foreigner whose country had been on the opposite side in the Great War, other factors stood strongly against him. His own lead counsel, Edward Riley, privately thought his client guilty and stated that he hoped Hauptmann would get the chair. Riley was at odds with the rest of the defense team for his poor handling of several aspects of the case, and spent a total of 38 minutes with Hauptmann before the trial. Riley came up with only one handwriting expert whose testimony was lackluster, and drove away another expert who was convinced she could prove the handwriting on the notes was not Hauptmann's. Riley's five-hour summation was chaotic and lame, delivered after a drinking bout at lunch. Most people there thought he was intoxicated. If we take into account not only Hauptmann's lead attorney making a mess of the case, but also the strong possibility that witnesses were swayed and that Hauptmann was abused by the police while in custody, what can we still say about the case against him? Not whether he got a perfect trial or even a fair trial, but whether or not he was the right guy. You may have noticed something curious in the way this narrative unfolded. In relating the events following the night of March 1, 1932, I generally referred to the kidnappers in the plural. In fact, the existence of multiple offenders was the working assumption of both the New Jersey State Police and the FBI. Yet once Bruno Hauptmann was arrested, all thought of more than one person's involvement seems to have evaporated. In fact, once Hauptmann was identified, most, if not all, serious work to uncover any other suspects ceased. Does this make sense? I don't think so. A couple of evidentiary items suggest more than one person. The first is Dr. Condon's belief that he heard some discussion between Cemetery John and another individual during his telephone conversation. The second is the impression by both Lindbergh and Al Reich that John had lookouts at the cemetery observing the car and looking for police. Then there are the details in the notes themselves. I don't pay serious attention to whether a ransom note speaks of I or we. In itself, that's meaningless in determining if more than one person is involved. What I tell my people is to stand back and look at what the entire communication is saying. And in this case, an elaborate story was presented about how the baby was being cared for by two nurses on board a boat. Clearly, this did not happen. The baby was dead and discarded the very night of the abduction. But this story is too elaborate for an otherwise unsophisticated offender to have made up just to get the money. In my opinion, the story of how the baby was being cared for and by whom represents the plan of what was supposed to happen. The baby's accidental death and the fall to the window ledge or foundation footings cancel all that. But you can't very well admit that and expect to get the money. So you stick with your original story, even down to stripping the sleeping suit off the corpse before you get rid of it. This all suggests to me more than one offender. As does the crime scene itself. Mark and I and our researcher Catherine Johnston Ramsland spent several hours in the Hopewell House. It is now a state-run school for teenaged boys, but the building is still very much as the Lindberghs left it, down to the original wood paneling in the library, and the mantel, and Delft tiles imported from Holland above the fireplace in the baby's nursery. Examining the house and the surrounding countryside, and analyzing the logistics, it is virtually inconceivable to us that one man alone could have pulled off this kidnapping. The easiest and most efficient way to place the ladder would have been directly in front of the nursery window, yet that would have put it directly in front of the library window on the first floor, where there was a good chance Colonel Lindbergh would have been sitting, so the ladder had to be positioned to the side. This corresponds with the impressions left in the ground, but makes access into the window and back out again extremely awkward. It would be nearly impossible for the intruder to maneuver from the ladder to the narrow window, pry it open, climb through, snatch the child, carry him in a bag back out the window and to the ladder without falling, never mind without dropping the bag. The only efficient way to get the child from the nursery window to the ladder is through a handoff. Was this a handoff of one intruder to another, or of a household staff member to an intruder? Could be either. But the dual intruder theory makes more sense because there is no good reason to suspect any of the servants in the house that night of direct complicity in the crime. But someone had the time to wipe down the room for prints, and this would have been someone sufficiently familiar with the room not to waste time. I just do not believe it was possible for one person to do all that, to drive close enough to the house at night, carry the ladder, the bag, and chisel up to the wall, climb up, climb in, and take the child all by himself. More than one individual took part in the crime that night. Add to this logistical issue the matter of intelligence. The criminals had up-to-the-minute knowledge. The baby was not supposed to be in Hopewell that night. Only a few people knew that. Was Bruno Hauptmann so unaware of the Lindbergh's habits that he just lucked into going to kidnap the baby on the one Tuesday of his life that he slept at Hopewell? Those are pretty long odds. Or did Hauptmann drive to Englewood, pull up at Next Day Hill, discover that the child was not there, then get back in his car with his ladder and drive for more than an hour, almost halfway across the state to Hopewell to carry out his mission? Once he got to Next Day Hill, how would he have found out? Did he sneak into this huge estate, not find the baby, then leave? Did he knock on the door and casually ask where he could find the Lindbergh baby? Was he able to accomplish this without anyone seeing him? It just doesn't make any sense, and it doesn't match with the timing of the kidnapping as it took place in Hopewell. Whoever took the baby that night had to have inside information. This doesn't mean one of the servants was consciously in on the crime, only that someone, likely Violet Sharp, let the information slip to someone else to whom the kidnappers had a direct line. Though he was meticulously investigated, nothing turned up to suggest any direct link between Hauptmann and anyone who would have had this information. Who done it? So, did Bruno Richard Hauptmann do it? I think he did something. If not, he is the victim of the most incredible, almost indescribable bad luck in the annals of law enforcement. That he was a semi-literate German immigrant, when all indications pointed to a semi-literate German immigrant as the writer of the ransom notes. that his handwriting and usage were close enough to the notes for a series of experts to declare it a match, that he resembled the eyewitness descriptions, that he had maps of the area near Hopewell because he said he used to hunt there, that he had come to the United States illegally after a series of crimes that included armed robbery and breaking and entering using a ladder, that he was a skilled carpenter with drawings of ladders in his notebooks when the key to the crime was an individually designed and constructed ladder, that there was another sketch of the money box in one of the ransom notes that looked like something a carpenter would draw, that he had purchased lumber and once worked for the establishment where some of the wood for the ladder had been purchased, that he had about a third of the ransom cash hidden in his garage, and he lied about it, that he had come into money and was able to start living a better lifestyle at exactly the same time as the ransom was passed, that he lived close to the cemetery where the original meeting with Cemetery John took place, and the cemetery where the ransom was handed over, that through a lapse of memory he forgot that he hadn't actually written Jaffe's address and phone number inside his son's closet. This string of bad luck would have extended so far as to exclude having bought a keg of nails from the same batch as those that were used in the kidnap ladder. We could go on, but I think you get the idea. Hauptmann had a compulsive, controlling personality. Like many men of his generation, he controlled his household. He controlled the money. He made the decisions. His wife went along docilely and willingly. He kept many secrets from her, and no one has suggested she knew anything of the kidnapping or the presence of the ransom money in the garage. She didn't even know his first name was Bruno until the police told her. She believed in him, and it is understandable that he didn't want to disappoint that belief, even at the cost of his life. So I have to conclude that Bruno Richard Hauptmann was involved in the Lindbergh kidnapping, though he did not work alone and was not necessarily the leader. His background showed him to be a risk-taker, both in terms of criminal record and in his means of getting to America. Moreover, that record suggested that when he did become involved with crime, it would be with others rather than alone. I suspect that he was approached by one or more others in the German immigrant community because of his background and his skills as a carpenter. The unrecovered money would have gone to them, some of which may have been laundered in the J.J. Faulkner bank deposit. Since kidnapping was rampant, this would have been perceived as a get-rich-quick scheme. And who better to try than the most famous man in the world? Hauptmann may or may not have actually been at the crime scene. He might have driven the car and taken the handoff. At this late date, absent physical evidence or the possibility of interviewing him, there is no way to know. If Hauptmann was Cemetery John, then he was probably not in the baby's room, because in the first meeting with Condon, John referred to the ransom note with signature as being left in the crib, perhaps the original plan, when, in fact, it was left on the windowsill. Could a shady group of German immigrants have had sufficient knowledge of the inside of the house to pull off the crime? Yes. For one thing, plans had been published. There is no substitute for first-hand experience in so delicate a crime as kidnapping, but even this we can account for. Mark Falzini came across an astounding document in the case archives that he called to our attention. It is from FBI New York Field Office File 62-3057, a 1932 summary of the case. Under a selection headed Aloysius Whately, commonly referred to as Ollie Whately, it reads in part, Whately entered the employ of Colonel and Mrs. Charles A. Lindbergh October 15, 1930, and with his wife acted as caretaker of the Lindbergh estate at Hopewell, New Jersey, and resided there continuously after the house was completed. Frequently, in the absence of the Lindberghs, he acted as guide to tourists and other curious visitors, showing them through the house and about the adjoining grounds. There you have it. Anyone could have conducted a reconnaissance run beforehand. This would have been impossible at Next Day Hill, the baby's normal place of residence, which was actually much closer and more convenient to the Bronx, practically just across the Hudson. But Hopewell was the more vulnerable location, so that was where the crime had to take place. And that required specific information. Whately died in May 1933 at 50 years of age after several months of illness, so this aspect was never followed up. Was the kidnap ringleader the mysterious Isidore Fish? Quite possibly, though little is known about him other than that he was a hustler who had bilked friends and other investors out of thousands of dollars in dubious schemes, including a pie-baking company. He was said by his family to be broke, and he departed the States owing a lot of money, yet Hauptmann said he left all this cash with him. One thing that is known is that Fish applied for his visa on May 12, 1932, the day the baby's corpse was found. Fish did not match the physical description of Cemetery John, which meant John either had to be Hauptmann or still another man was involved. I've come out many times publicly in support of the death penalty. I've stated that I'd be more than willing personally to pull the switch on some of the monsters I've hunted in my career with the FBI. But Bruno Hauptmann just doesn't fit into this category. The evidence just wasn't and isn't there to have confidently sent him to the electric chair. To impose the one sentence for which there is no retroactive correction requires a far higher standard of proof than was seen here. Blaming him for the entire crime was, to my mind, an expedient and simple-minded solution to a private horror that had become a national obsession. I am troubled, for instance, that even after he was convicted and sentenced to death and appeals were denied, when Hauptmann was thrown a lifeline that would have spared him, he refused to grasp it. A number of people in authority came to his cell, including the governor of New Jersey, saying that the death sentence would be set aside if only he would confess to something. All he had to do to save his life and spare his wife and son all that anguish was to say who else had been involved in the crime and what their roles had been. And yet he refused, saying simply that he was innocent and therefore had no knowledge of who might have done it. Not having had the opportunity to interview him myself, it is difficult to say for sure what his motive was. Based on my knowledge of other sociopathic offenders, I suspect this was probably stubbornness, arrogance, the honor among thieves of not ratting out on a fellow comrade, and an unwillingness to disgrace his family and his name. Perhaps he was afraid for his family's safety if he spilled. As we've seen, there is enough evidence of high-risk behavior in Hauptmann's background to make this likely. But not certain. I have to say that this refusal to trade his life for any verbal concession inevitably complicates the assessment. It is also a matter of record that Hauptmann asked repeatedly for a lie detector test, and that one be administered to Dr. Condon. My colleagues and associates know I have never set much store in the polygraph, and I'm always wary of the results, but it is unreasonable to think that Hauptmann had such a knowledgeable or jaundiced view. If he asked for such a test, unless this was a clever ploy he knew would never be followed up, he must have believed he could pass. We can say that throughout her long life, she died on October 10, 1994, the 69th anniversary of her marriage at age 95, Anna Hauptmann believed fervently in her husband's innocence and did everything in her power to convince others and have the case reopened. Was a better and more satisfying solution to this infamous case possible? Yes, but not once certain key bridges were crossed. The greatest single mistake, though it was made for understandable reasons, was allowing Colonel Lindbergh to dictate limitations on the police. In any kidnapping, the major risk for the offender is picking up the package. Had police been allowed to cover the money drop, the chances are great they would have picked up Cemetery John. It wouldn't have saved the baby, but the case would have been cracked. You cannot lose control of a case. If you do, it's going to be difficult to get it back. After the first meeting with Cemetery John, we would have wanted to debrief Condon and would have gleaned valuable information from him. For example, the passing reference to burning if the baby were dead could have been used during the second encounter, playing on his fears and sense of guilt to get to the others. Likewise, Schwarzkopf could have been more proactive in his assumptions regarding an inside job. If we were working this case today, we would have assessed each household servant, then tried to show each one how we didn't think he or she had purposely aided the kidnappers, but that someone had been tricked or duped, and we had to have that information. I would have done everything in my power to get the Lindberghs themselves involved with this tactic, so the staff would regard it seriously. During the first encounter with Cemetery John, the offender went to some lengths to convince Dr. Condon that both Betty Gow and her boyfriend Red Johnson were innocent. Why even bother bringing up information about the servants and their friends if this wasn't an avenue they wanted the investigators to avoid? This was just one area that could have been better explored to get vital information when it would still have been useful. And there are so many other strategies that could have been tried, but were not. Instead, what we are left with is a classic American tragedy. Chapter 4. The Zodiac. One thing that motivates many serial offenders is the desire to create and sustain their own mythology. The press is often a willing collaborator, giving them such names as the Freeway Phantom, the Hillside Strangler, the Green River Killer. When the media is not so cooperative, they often insist upon their own designations, such as the Son of Sam, or the BTK for Bind, Torture, and Kill Strangler. The reasons they feel a need to do this are obvious to those of us in criminal investigative analysis. These are insignificant nobodies whose only accomplishment in life, the only time when they feel in control and fulfilled, is when they are causing suffering or fear in others. Among the most successful in establishing and preserving his mythology was the unsub known as the Zodiac. The Zodiac crimes remain unsolved, the offender never identified or caught. And of all the cases about which I am frequently asked, this one comes up as much as any. Particularly on the West Coast, this is one that continues to haunt. The first shall be last. It was the day before Halloween, Sunday, October 30th, 1966, in Riverside, California, about 60 miles southeast of Los Angeles. Joseph Bates and his 18-year-old daughter, Sherry Jo, began their day together, going to Mass at St. Catherine's Church, then having breakfast at Sandy's restaurant. After that, they split up, with Joseph heading for the beach and Sherry Jo planning to do some schoolwork. A cheerleader for Riverside City College and at Ramona High before that, Sherry Jo was the all-American California dream girl. Blonde hair, blue eyes, attractive tan, 5'3" and 110 pounds. A freshman at RCC, she was an honor student who held down a job at a local bank and aspired to a career as a flight attendant. Since her mother's departure a year earlier, and with her brother serving in the Navy across the country in Florida, Sherry Jo lived alone with her father, who worked at Corona Naval Ordnance Laboratory as a machinist. Around mid-afternoon, Sherry Jo decided to go to the college library. She called a friend to see if she wanted to go along, but her friend was busy, so Sherry Jo went on her own. She was gone by the time Joseph returned home, but had left her father a note. When he went back out, he left a note for his daughter in return. Joseph Bates wasn't worried when he came back around midnight and saw that the note he had left his daughter hadn't been touched. After all, she was old enough to socialize that late and take care of herself. Thinking she was probably with a few of her girlfriends, he went to sleep. But by the next morning, she still hadn't returned. He called a friend to see if Sherry Jo was at her house, and, when she wasn't, reported his daughter missing to the police. Within the hour, Sherry Jo Bates was no longer a missing person. Her body was found by a college groundskeeper, lying face down on the gravel path to the library parking lot. She had been stabbed in the chest and left shoulder, and slashed in the face and neck, her jugular vein and larynx both severed. The assault was so violent that she was nearly decapitated. Riverside police tried to reconstruct Sherry Jo's final hours. A co-worker at the Riverside National Bank had received a call from her around 5:30 p.m., asking if she'd seen the bibliography for a term paper Sherry Jo was writing. That was the last time anyone reported talking to her. A little after 6 p.m., one of her friends said she saw Sherry Jo driving toward the library in her light green Volkswagen. Someone else reported seeing a blonde woman in a car like Sherry Jo's, and also noticed a bronze-colored Oldsmobile that followed closely behind. This detail became important in the context of Sherry Jo's assault. When investigators examined her VW still parked at the library with newly checked-out books on the front seat, They found it had been tampered with, a wire to the distributor disconnected, among other actions. Police, who conducted an impressive, exhaustive investigation, theorized that her assailant followed her to the library, disabled her car, then waited for his prey. He likely watched as she tried to start the car several times unsuccessfully, then offered her help or a ride. Whether he was a stranger or known to her, she trusted him enough that she went with him down the dark path where he attacked. Sherry Jo was small but athletic, and she put up a hell of a fight. One report compared the area where she died to a freshly plowed field. She had human hair and skin under her fingernails. A wristwatch, thought to belong to the unsub, was found 10 feet from her body. The band had been completely torn away from the face on one side, ripped off in Sherry Joe's desperate struggle. The timing of the murder, however, was confusing. Two people in the area that night reported hearing screams between 10:15 and 10:45 p.m., but the library closed at 9 p.m. on Sunday nights. Did Sherry Joe and her murderer talk for more than an hour before he killed her? Even more important, there was no apparent motive. The victim's purse was found next to her body with her identification intact and less than a dollar in change. The M.O., disabling her car and lying in wait, was too complicated for a robbery, and a young college student off for an afternoon or evening of studying hardly made a worthy target for that. There was no sign of sexual assault, and nothing in the young woman's background suggested she was a high-risk victim. At Sherry Joe's funeral 5 days later, investigators scanned the crowd as her bereaved father collapsed in his grief. Like Joseph Bates, they were no closer to understanding why she had died. An answer of sorts arrived by mail the next month in a letter to the Riverside Police. The author was clever, typing the document in all caps through perhaps a dozen or so pages of carbon paper, then mailing one taken from the bottom of the stack, rendering it so full of smudges that while its message was legible, it would be next to impossible to trace it to a specific typewriter. Of course, there were no fingerprints. And the writer was not only cunning in avoiding identification, he knew to include enough details of Sherry Joe's murder to gain credibility as her killer. He began with a taunting lead-in, the word "bye," with nothing but empty space following. The document read, "She was young and beautiful, but now she is battered and dead. She is not the first, and she will not be the last. I lay awake nights thinking about my next victim. Maybe she will be the beautiful blonde that babysits near the little store and walks down the dark alley each evening about 7. Or maybe she will be the shapely blue-eyed brunette that said no when I asked her for a date in high school. Or maybe it will not be either. But I shall cut off her female parts and deposit them for the whole city to see. So don't make it so easy for me. Keep your sisters, daughters, and wives off the streets and alleys." The author went on to describe in precise detail how he removed the middle wire from the distributor. The police had not released this information publicly. The next section of the letter was a grotesque description of Sherry Joe's death, including the moment the unsub abruptly turned from Good Samaritan to ruthless killer. "When we were away from the library walking, I said it was about time. She asked me, 'About time for what?' I said it was about time for you to die. I grabbed her around the neck with my hand over her mouth and my other hand with a small knife at her throat." At one point, the author alluded to a possible motive. "Only one thing was on my mind, making her pay for the brush-offs that she had given me during the years prior." Police did find a young man who knew Sherry Joe and could be linked circumstantially to the crime. Even years later, some investigators considered him the strongest suspect, but there was never enough to bring him to trial. From my experience, I would suggest that this citation, like the one to the shapely blue-eyed brunette before it, refers more to what the killer sees as female rejection in general than to a specific woman. I say this because of the letter's larger theme, echoed in his closing section. "I am not sick. I am insane. But that will not stop the game. This letter should be published for all to read it. It just might save that girl in the alley. But that's up to you. It will be on your conscience, not mine. Beware. I am stalking your girls now. It was probably at least somewhat truthful when the killer wrote of his next possible victim. Despite his reference to the brush-offs, Sherry Joe's killer was probably out on the hunt that night, spotted the pretty young girl in her car and followed her, then set his trap and waited. She could have been a blonde in a dark alley. Any victim would do. With this letter, her killer set in motion what he really wanted, to put the fear of God in the community that any woman or girl could be next. It was all a game to him. What further supports this as his motive is that, while police remained fearful of another attack, none came. The unsub was happy with what he'd accomplished. He didn't need to kill again in the near future. He could just watch and wait. This ability to wait for the right time to strike again was clear from the crime, which bore the marks of a highly organized offender. Despite what he wrote, this crime was not the work of an insane person, but a methodical and cunning one, capable of hunting for just the right victim, preferably a stranger. This unsub was able to set his trap, the disabled automobile, seem normal and helpful enough in behavior and appearance to win his victim's trust, lure her into an area where it would be safe for him to attack, and then get away without attracting attention. There are a few disorganized elements, such as that Sherry Joe was left where she was killed with no real effort to hide her body. Also, the unsub appeared to have more trouble controlling his victim than he expected, as shown by the presence of the watch, as well as the physical evidence under her nails. But these seem to be the marks of a youthful and/or criminally unsophisticated offender, rather than an indication that a true disorganized personality is involved. And certainly we have no indication that more than one unsub committed this crime. Indeed, this is the type of offender we'd expect to learn from this experience and correct the disorganized elements his next time out. Months went by, and police found no evidence the killer had made good on his threats against another woman. Unfortunately, there was also no real progress in the investigation. The only development in the case was the discovery by a custodian of vandalism on the top of a desk that had been in the RCC library at the time of Sherry Joe's murder. 5 months had passed, but the words etched into the wood in blue pen stood out for their disturbing message. It was a poem of sorts. Sick of living, unwilling to die. Cut. Clean. If red. Clean. Blood spurting, dripping, spilling. All over her new dress. Oh well, it was red anyway. Life draining into an uncertain death. She won't die. This time someone'll find her. Just wait till next time. R.H. The police could not conclusively link the strange writings to the murder, but they filed away a photocopy of the desktop along with the rest of the Bates materials. I've often found that anniversaries are good opportunities to lay traps for offenders of unsolved crimes. These dates are important to them for a variety of reasons. The local paper, the Riverside Press Enterprise, carried a story on the unsolved crime on April 30, 1967, the 6 month anniversary of the murder. Someone made contact the next day. This time there were three recipients: the police, the Press Enterprise, and Joseph Bates. Each received a short, penciled message on a piece of loose-leaf paper that read simply, "Bates had to die. There will be more." The notes were signed with what looked like the letter Z or the number 2. Since there was nothing to compare the handwriting to, the earlier letter had been typed, and no credibility-sealing details, the police considered these notes a hoax generated by publicity from the newspaper article. Stranger crimes, those with no known connection between the victim and the offender, are the most difficult to solve because, unless there is a witness, or the unsub leaves some evidence to link himself to his victim, forensic or behavioral, police have no reason to look in his direction. It would be 4 years before this terrible crime was seen in the context of an even greater horror. Lover's Lane. December 20th, 1968 was a Friday, and teenagers David Arthur Faraday and Betty Lou Jensen had plans for a date that night. Faraday, 17 years of age, was an excellent student and athlete at Vallejo High School in Vallejo, California, and an Eagle Scout. Because she lived on another side of town, Jensen attended a different school, Hogan High, where the pretty 16-year-old was also known as a good student. Although they apparently misled their parents about where they were going, her parents thought they were going to a concert at school and then to a party, but they skipped the concert altogether, they were known as good kids. Neither would be considered a high-risk victim. David picked up Betty Lou and his mother's 1961 Rambler station wagon, and they left her parents' house around 8:30 p.m. The two first went to visit a friend until about 9, then to Mr. Ed's drive-in for a Coke, before heading out to Lake Herman Road, known as a local Lover's Lane. They parked off the road in a gravel strip just outside an entrance to the Lake Herman pumping station. It was an ideal place for young lovers to spend some time alone, but its isolation also proved dangerous. Around 11:15, a woman who lived on Lake Herman Road, a couple of miles from where the teens had parked, came upon the site while going to pick up her son from a show. The passenger door of Faraday's car was open. David lay on his back in a pool of blood, his feet toward the rear wheel. Betty Lou Jensen was nearly 30 feet from the back of the car, apparently as far as she could run before someone shot her dead. The horrified woman drove off for help and flagged down a Benicia police car. Captain Daniel Pitta and Officer William T. Warner rushed to the scene. When they got there, Faraday was still breathing. They summoned an ambulance. The Rambler's motor was warm, the ignition still on, presumably to keep the car's heater running. Although the front passenger door was open, the three other doors and tailgate were locked. This, plus the location of the bodies, seemed to indicate that the killer somehow herded his victims out the one door so they couldn't flee in different directions. A trail of blood led from the car to where Betty Lou had fallen, and more blood from her nose and mouth pooled around her body. She had been shot 5 times in her upper back. All the shots were on the right side in a close pattern, quite a feat of marksmanship given that the girl was running for her life in the darkness. David had been shot in the head at closer range, the bullet traveling forward from behind his left ear. Betty Lou was dead at the scene. David was rushed by ambulance to Vallejo General Hospital. We've discussed in earlier chapters how investigations can get complicated, even in some instances compromised, when multiple jurisdictions are involved. In this case, the two Benicia officers were there first because the woman who'd found the crime scene had spotted them. The crime actually occurred, however, outside Benicia's jurisdiction. So when Captain Pitta called in the county coroner, he also got in touch with the Solano County Sheriff's Office so they could send investigators out to the scene. Around midnight, representatives from both jurisdictions were present to investigate. They were joined by Detective Sergeant Les Lundblad of the Sheriff's Office. Ultimately, all the work Benicia police did on the case was handed over to the Sheriff's Office. While Lundblad investigated the crime scene, he sent two of his officers to get a statement from the surviving victim. But when they got to the ICU, they learned David Faraday had been declared DOA at 12:05. So what had happened? A number of witnesses had seen David's car parked at what would later become the crime scene, including a couple who passed by twice between 10:15 and 10:30 p.m., and two hunters who noticed the Rambler just after 11. Although David apparently turned the car around after parking it, possibly to provide more privacy, there was nothing inherently suspicious about the scene. But investigators uncovered one odd, possibly related incident in the area that night. Two other young people on a date had stopped on the side of the road to check their vehicle's engine. They reported being passed by a car, described tentatively as a blue Plymouth Valiant, which first slowed and then backed up toward them. Something about the situation spooked the couple, and they hurriedly drove off, only to be followed by the mysterious car until they exited to head toward Benicia. This occurred around 9:30 p.m. Several of the people who'd seen David's car also reported seeing a white 4-door Chevrolet Impala at the entrance to the pumping station around the same time. These vehicles could provide clues to what had happened, or they could be red herrings. The only witnesses to the crime, other than the unsub, were dead. There was also little in the way of physical evidence. No fingerprints, no tire tracks, no signs of a struggle. There were light shoe prints in front of the car and one heel print nearby. The offender did expend ammunition in his rampage, and investigators gathered that evidence. Empty shell casings from a .22 were found in the car on the floorboard and outside, and several slugs were recovered from the car and the victim's bodies. The murder weapon was gauged to be a J.C. Higgins Model 80 automatic or a high-standard Model 101 semi-automatic, using a type of copper-coated Super X bullet produced by Winchester since October 1967. With no signs of robbery or sexual assault, police looked to victimology, hoping for a clue as to the unsub's motive. The Jensens told investigators that Betty Lou had been bothered by a boy whose romantic intentions she did not return. They said he even threatened David at one point. When the sheriff's office followed up on these leads, however, they found the boy had a solid alibi for the night of the murder. Betty Lou had also told her sister she thought someone was spying on her, and her mother found the side yard gate open a couple of times, but nothing was found to connect these incidents to the murders. This type of crime is emotionally difficult to investigate. Nothing in the victimology indicated why these two young people had been killed, and the motive was unclear. I want to report a double murder. Darlene Farron was a gregarious, sociable young lady, 22, who lived in Vallejo with her husband Dean and their baby daughter Dina. Shortly after the murders at the pumping station, she told one of her co-workers at Terry's restaurant that she knew the victims, or at least knew of them, from having attended Hogan High School, located about a block from where Betty Lou Jensen lived. Darlene found their murders so frightening, she said she wouldn't be going back to that area again. About 6 months after the Jensen Faraday murders, on the afternoon of the 4th of July, Darlene called a friend, Mike Majot, to see about getting together that evening. Then, leaving Dina at home with babysitters, Darlene stopped by the Italian restaurant where Dean worked, not the same one where Darlene was employed, to tell him that she and a younger sister, Christina, were heading off to a parade of boats on nearby Murr Island. Dean told her he'd invited some of his co-workers over for a party after work and asked her to pick up fireworks on her way home. She and Christina went to Terry's restaurant to invite friends to the party before going to the parade. She also called Mike again. After the parade, they stopped by Dean's work. By now, it was after 10 p.m. Darlene called to check on her daughter and was told someone at Terry's was trying to get in touch with her, so she went back to the restaurant. Then she drove Christina home and returned to her own house. Originally, her plan was to take her babysitters home and then clean up her house for the party. But after a phone call, she instead asked the sitters, two young girls, if they could stay while she went out to get fireworks. They agreed, and Darlene drove to Mike Majot's house, where Mike was so anxious to see her that he ran out of the house without turning off the TV or lights, leaving the door open. As they left his house, they quickly realized they were being followed by another car, light in color. They tried to lose it and ended up on Columbus Parkway, a route that headed away from town. They turned into Blue Rock Springs Golf Course, not quite as isolated as the Lake Herman Road pumping station, but also known as a lover's lane. As Darlene pulled into the parking lot, her Chevy Corvair stalled out as the other vehicle pulled up. It parked nearby before speeding off, only to return minutes later. As Mike would later recall, the other car pulled into position behind them almost as a police car would, cutting them off and shining its lights into Darlene's car. The next thing he knew, he heard something against the car window, then saw a flash of light as he was shot. The bullets kept coming. Darlene fell onto the steering wheel, struck 9 times altogether, 2 in each arm and 5 in the back, hitting a lung and her heart. Mike tried to escape but was unable to find the door handle. As he struggled, he saw the shooter returning to his car. At one point, the man turned, and Mike got a good look at him. In his late 20s, he was stocky, maybe 200 pounds, about 5'8", with light brown hair, curly, cut in a crew cut. He wore a windbreaker like those worn by people in the Navy, and pleated pants, which didn't hide a slight paunch. As his attacker seemed to be leaving, Mike let out a cry of pain, and the man changed direction, going back to Darlene's car. He shot Mike twice more as his desperate victim jumped into the back seat. Then he shot twice more at Darlene, walked back to his car, and left. Mike made his way out of Darlene's car by opening the door from the outside and falling out. He was bleeding from his face, neck, right arm, and left leg. One of the bullets had cut through his jawbone and tongue, so he couldn't even scream. Fortunately, three other young people were out that night looking for a friend of theirs. They drove into the parking lot and discovered Michaud, writhing on the ground. They raced off to summon help. Just 10 minutes after midnight, the call came into the Vallejo police switchboard. The two officers first on scene were quickly followed by Detective Sergeant John Lynch and Sergeant Ed Rust. And the scene was horrible. Mike Michaud, bleeding profusely, was in a lot of pain, and Darlene was barely alive behind the wheel. Lynch laid Darlene out on the parking lot as they waited for an ambulance. She seemed to try to tell them something, but it was unintelligible. Lynch and Rust had actually heard a report of shots being fired. It had been called in by the son of the groundskeeper at the golf course, who heard the gunfire and the sound of a car leaving quickly. But it was the 4th of July, and the police figured it was fireworks. According to an interview Lynch gave Robert Graysmith, journalist and author of the comprehensive book Zodiac, he and his partner felt terrible later, wondering if had they responded more quickly, would they have passed the suspect vehicle as it fled the scene? On top of that, when they arrived, they realized they knew one of the victims. Darlene knew a lot of the local police from the restaurant where she worked. She'd even dated them. And she and Dean lived next door to the Vallejo Sheriff's Office. She was pronounced DOA at 12:30 a.m. at Kaiser Foundation Hospital. Mike Michaud was critical and faced surgery to his jaw, arm, and leg, but would recover from his physical injuries. At the crime scene, detectives found the Corvair's windows were open on both sides with the ignition on. The car was still in low gear, the radio on, and Darlene hadn't applied the parking brake. All this was consistent with Mike Michaud's description of how the car had stalled. The subject had caught up to them before she had a chance to either properly park or get going again. Inside the bloody car, along with Darlene's purse and Mike's wallet, investigators found spent 9mm shell casings. Michaud's description of the events made no mention of the unsub stopping to reload, and at least 9 shots had been fired, so the weapon was thought to be a Browning semi-automatic. Comparisons between this and the shootings at Lake Herman Road just 2 miles away seemed inevitable. In both instances, the subject approached young couples as they sat in a car in an isolated location at night. Both times, a gun was used. But in this case, according to the surviving witness, the subject actively and aggressively pursued the victim's car, almost herding it to the crime scene. And in this case, the victimology yielded clues that this was not a stranger crime, and that perhaps more easily discernible motives applied. As police looked into the victim's backgrounds, they discovered that Darlene Farron may not have been a random target. According to friends and associates, she liked to go out, and was often in the company of men other than her husband, Mike Michaud, for example. But this seemed to irk Dean's friends and co-workers more than it bothered him. When they brought it up, he would defend his wife, reminding them she was still young and free-spirited. It was all innocent fun, he insisted, not as if she were having affairs. This was also the California of 1969. And he had an airtight alibi that night. He was with his co-workers. But there were other men in Darlene's life to investigate, including her first husband, Jim, who'd owned a gun. Darlene was said to be afraid of him. But he didn't match the physical description of her killer, and police ruled him out as a suspect. Another man, described as a persistent, frustrated suitor, was ruled out when police found he was home with his wife when the murder occurred. Witnesses say another man spied on Darlene at home from a white American car parked in front of her house. One babysitter reported that when she had told Darlene about the man in the car, Darlene had said she'd seen him kill someone. Darlene's sister Pam also described a man in a white car who had delivered mysterious packages to the Farron's home, including a package he warned Pam not to open. She'd seen him several times and described him as dark-haired and well-dressed. Sometimes he wore horn-rimmed glasses. Another sister, Linda, also saw this man at Darlene's house. He showed up at a party she threw to get the place painted. According to Linda, Darlene told her to steer clear of him. The babysitter and Darlene's sisters all reported Darlene seemed afraid of this man, who had also been spotted watching her at work at Terry's. On the night she was killed, Darlene had a tense conversation in the parking lot of the restaurant with a man who drove a white car, as witnessed by her sister Christina. Around the end of June, just before she was murdered, Darlene predicted to Christina that something big was going to happen. Darlene couldn't or wouldn't give her any details, but it would be big enough to get in the papers. People close to Darlene theorized that when she'd gone to the Virgin Islands with her first husband on their honeymoon, they might have fallen in with a rough crowd. Had she seen or heard about a murder there? Were drugs involved? But in the end, all of this speculation led no closer to the identity of her killer. Mike Majot was also an interesting character. He and Darlene had met at Terry's when he was there with his twin brother David. The 19-year-olds were said to have a competition going, vying desperately for Darlene's attentions, fighting over who could get to do favors for her. On the 4th of July, Mike was wearing several layers of clothing, which stunned police, until he explained to Detective Lynch that he was self-conscious about his slight build and wore more clothes to try to fill out his appearance. According to several people who talked to Robert Graysmith, Majot also gave different versions of the events that night depending on who asked the questions and when they asked. Variations included how the two ended up at Blue Rock Springs, whether they were randomly followed, or whether they met up with someone who argued with Darlene first and were then followed to the parking lot, the physical description of the unsub and his vehicle, and so on. Darlene's sister Pam thought Mike believed Darlene knew their assailant, and Mike was trying to protect her because he loved her. In any event, after he recovered, he moved away. At 12:40 a.m. on July 5th, a call came into the Vallejo police switchboard. A man's voice told Operator Nancy Slover that there had been a double murder. He gave such precise directions to the scene that it sounded to her as if he'd either rehearsed it or was reading from a script. He did not allow her to interrupt him with questions, and he continued speaking until he was done. For credibility, in addition to the exact description of where the crime scene was, he told her he'd shot his victims with a 9mm Luger. Then he claimed credit for killing those kids last year, said goodbye, and hung up. I have no doubt that the caller was working from a script. This was a highly organized offender. He knew the call would be traced, and he had only a brief time to establish credibility and say his piece before getting off. If the police were able to develop a suspect shortly after this shooting, I would have advised them to include notes with directions or drafts of a full script on a scrap of paper in their search warrant, just as we often do in extortion or kidnapping cases. It took 7 minutes for Pacific Telephone to trace the call to a payphone in front of a service station right near both the Vallejo Sheriff's Office and the home Darlene shared with her husband and daughter. A witness who'd been walking by the phone booth at the time had seen a man inside described as stocky, matching Mike Majot's first description of the shooter. About an hour later, around 1:30 a.m., crank calls were received at Darlene's home, at Dean Farron's brother's house, and Dean's parents' house. In each instance, the caller said nothing, and the person answering just heard the sound of someone breathing. The phone calls, and the location of the phone booth from which the killer reported his work, made it seem that the unsub knew at least one of his recent victims. For one thing, the calls were made before news of the shootings, much less the identities of the victims, had been made public. I know from experience that many offenders derive great satisfaction from calling in a report of their crime while looking into the home of their victim, waiting to see the effects of their work. But Darlene and Dean had only lived in the home by the sheriff's office for a few months before her murder. Their old address was the one in the phone book. If this offender chose that payphone so he could gloat over the experience, he'd need to know not only her name, but be familiar enough with her life to know that she'd recently moved. Was it the mysterious man in the white car Darlene feared? Of course, it's also possible the unsub didn't know whom he'd shot and simply picked the payphone by the sheriff's office to taunt authorities. It makes sense that in looking for a suspect with a connection to these victims, the emphasis would be on Darlene. In addition to the victimology, the crime scene itself tells us she was the focus of the offender's rage. She overwhelmingly bore the brunt of the attack, with many more and more serious gunshot wounds than her companion. In an attack of this nature, it would make more sense for the male, who normally represents the greater physical threat to the offender, to be the more seriously injured. Also, since the killer took his shots from Majot's side of the car, one would expect Darlene to be more likely to survive the attack. But assuming the unsub did not know his victim or victims, the focus of the attack on the female is still telling. We saw this in the Son of Sam crimes in New York when David Berkowitz intentionally went to the woman's side of the car with his .44 Magnum. The male companions were only secondary considerations. According to Majot, the killer doubled back to fire more shots at both of his victims before he left. Given that Majot was already wounded and vulnerable, we might have expected the shooter to make sure to finish him off this time. But instead, he expended two of the four additional bullets at Farron, who he could see was already mortally wounded. The male victim was not only left alive, but was able to describe the unsub. Less than a month after Darlene's murder, the self-proclaimed killer made contact once again, but this time to the press instead of the police, and this time by mail. The San Francisco Chronicle, the San Francisco Examiner, and Vallejo Times-Herald all received nearly identical letters from an author claiming to be the serial killer. The letter to the Chronicle began, "Dear Editor, this is the murderer of the two teenagers last Christmas at Lake Herman, and the girl on the 4th of July near the golf course in Vallejo. To prove I killed them, I shall state some facts which only I and the police know." The letters went on to provide details for each of the two cases, including ammunition used and the position of the victims' bodies. Enclosed with each communication was a section of a long, complicated, coded message made up of neatly printed symbols. Each newspaper had received one-third. According to the letters, when solved, the cryptogram would reveal the identity of the killer. I don't imagine most in the law enforcement community actually believe the murderer was giving us his name, but I've always said that when a subject starts communicating with us, that's a good sign. Compare this with a case like Unabomb, where we also had few solid leads. You'd much rather get your behavioral clues from a letter than a murder scene. When he makes contact, this is when you start to feel you can catch the guy. His arrogance and feelings of power lead him to reveal more of himself, giving us the means to help someone in the public recognize him, as in the case of the Unabomber, Theodore Kaczynski, and enlightening us as to his motives so we can design effective, proactive techniques to flush him out. When you have a series of cases where traditional motives such as greed, anger, and revenge don't apply, the information you get from his communiques is invaluable in elucidating his motives. In this instance, the killer didn't stop in taking credit for his crimes and taunting police with his coded puzzle. It wasn't enough for police to know he was the real deal. He wanted every reader of all the local newspapers to know of and fear him. "I want you to print this cipher on the front page of your paper. If you do not print this cipher by the afternoon of Friday, 1st of August, 69, I will go on a kill rampage Friday night. I will cruise around all weekend killing lone people in the night, then move on to kill again, until I end up with a dozen people over the weekend." The papers, in cooperation with the police, published part of the letters without reproducing the entire text. As with other aspects of their investigations, authorities wanted some things held back so that there would still be details only the unsub would know. For him, knowledge of these would provide a means for him to establish credibility in later communications. And for law enforcement, ideally, it would set the stage for future identification and prosecution. Ironically, while the cryptogram would not prove to contain the author's identity explicitly stated, it did provide valuable clues in ways likely unintended by the unsub. For one thing, when an unsub goes to the trouble of putting something like that together, you know you're not dealing with your average jerk murderer. Not only is this guy meticulous and obviously proud of proving his intellectual superiority to the police to compensate for his general feelings of inadequacy, but he also enjoys these incredibly detail-oriented tasks. Think of how much time it would take just to painstakingly write out each of those cryptogram characters, all the while trying to mask your natural handwriting. One misguided stroke, and you'd have to start over. It's almost the patience of a bomb maker. Then there are the symbols themselves. The average reader of a local newspaper would not be familiar with most of the characters in the cryptogram's text, which included meteorological and astrological symbols, Morse and Navy semaphore code, and various Greek symbols. We're dealing with someone with exposure to, if not extensive training in, some highly specialized areas. Even if he was not well-versed in these areas, he'd need reference books with the symbols to copy. Although we'd expect this unsub to be a loner, family members or associates would know that along with that trait, he'd have this type of educational or work background. Like the bomb maker, this subject would view his letters and this code, like the murders, as his art. We would expect him to have a work area set aside where he would do his meticulous printing and keep his reference materials, books on codes, code breaking, symbols, as well as media coverage of his crimes and communications. It's not as easy to notice as a locked garage or basement room that sometimes emits smoke or strange noises, but it's a sacred, organized workspace about which this subject would be compulsively protective. Let's try to relate these character traits specifically to one of the crimes. Whether you assume that Darlene Farren knew her killer or not, her murder was not the act of an enraged boyfriend wannabe, or someone looking to cover his ass on an earlier crime. This unsub was on an intellectual campaign of terror, and his target was much greater than any single individual. It seems fitting, then, that although the police enlisted assistance from experts, including those at Naval Intelligence, the National Security Agency, the CIA, and the FBI, in the end, it was a couple of newspaper-reading, concerned citizens who finally deciphered the killer's writings. The newspapers printed their sections of the code in different editions on different days, but by Sunday, August 3rd, all three parts were available to the public. Donald Gene Harden, a 41-year-old high school history and economics teacher, and his wife, Betty June, spent the next couple of days working to crack the code. All the consulted experts agreed with their solution. "I like killing people because it is so much fun. It is more fun than killing wild game in the forest because man is the most dangerous animal of all to kill. Something gives me the most thrilling experience. It is even better than getting your rocks off with a girl. The best part of it is that when I die, I will be reborn in paradise. And thy have killed will become my slaves. I will not give you my name because you will try to sloy down or atop my collectiog of slaves for afterlife. Ibio rit methipti." The solution only provided more proof of the author's cunning. For example, in their analysis of such messages, codebreakers try to apply some basic rules. The letter E is typically the most commonly used. To cover his tracks, this cryptogram's designer used a total of 7 symbols to stand for the letter E. As you can see from reading it, there were numerous misspellings, but it is not obvious which were true mistakes on the part of the author and which were planted. In analyzing the message, much has been made of the reference to the author's rebirth in paradise and his use of victims as slaves. I would argue that this is less telling as an indicator of our unsub's religious beliefs and more revealing in the context of other parts of the message, such as his reference to man as the most dangerous animal of all, which sounds a lot like the title of the famous Richard Connell short story, The Most Dangerous Game. The story, which has been made into a movie several times, is about a wealthy madman who lives on his own island and lures passing sailors to dangerous reefs close to his shores with phony navigational lights. He rescues them from their shipwrecks, only to release and hunt them like wild animals in his compound. Now, this doesn't mean that the serial killer is a literary genius or even particularly well-read, since the 1924 story has been required reading in many high schools, or the killer could have seen a movie rendition. But it does seem highly coincidental that he would use that turn of phrase, given the awkwardness of other parts of his message. I would suggest this shows a fair degree of education. I would also suggest that the author was being truthful when he said that killing was even better than getting your rocks off with a girl, since I don't think he had much experience with that. As discussed earlier, men with successful, fulfilling relationships with women don't generally gun them down. It is worth noting, too, that the unsub didn't go on a killing rampage the weekend the letters were received, despite the fact that the San Francisco Examiner missed the Friday publication deadline, publishing their section of the cryptogram on Sunday. This doesn't surprise me. The Unabomber threatened to blow up an airliner out of Los Angeles over a holiday weekend. He didn't actually do it, but reveled in the attention and fear it generated. Another thing that's better to this subject than getting his rocks off with a girl is watching the public, police, and media sit in fear, waiting for him to do something. Every girl unattainable to him knew of his threat. All the guys who got those girls heard about him on the news. Law enforcement from all over the country worked all weekend trying to crack his code. That was exciting to him. That was real power. Finally, there was the matter of the leftover letters at the end of the cryptogram. When the solution was published, the public rushed to interpret the last line as an anagram for the author's name. Police followed up as names emerged, but as you might imagine, were unable to find a suspect this way. In the meantime, Vallejo Chief of Police Jackie Stilts went public, expressing doubts that the letters and cryptogram were even from the real killer.